Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 19th of November. The Voting Rights Act, this hour of the program, our guest in a recent piece, November 14, to be exact, in the New York Times, titled, Is the Voting Rights Act Doom?, writes, does the re-election of the first black president mean the Voting Rights Act of 1965 is unnecessary and perhaps unconstitutional? The Supreme Court's decision to consider a constitutional challenge to a key section of the act suggests that a perverse outcome of the 2012 campaign may be that President Obama's victory spells doom for the civil rights law most responsible for African American enfranchisement. We'll be talking about the question in the constitutional debate, why the Supreme Court took up the challenge to the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the history of the act, what it has done, and whether or not it needs to be changed. That the, as our guest suggests, that challengers to the act argue with some reason the list of covered jurisdictions no longer resembles America's most wanted of voting rights violators. Maybe there should be a new list. Maybe no list. Our phone number for you to join the conversation with our guest, who is Nathaniel Persily of Columbia Law School, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Nathaniel Persily, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Why don't we start, if you wouldn't mind, with a history of the Voting Rights Act, why we got it in this country?
Well, in 1965, President Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law, and it has several provisions. But the one that was the strongest and most effective and which is at issue today is Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And in particular, that was there to target Southern recalcitrant Dixiecrat legislatures who were doing everything in their power to prevent African Americans from voting. That law is unlike any other law on the books. It requires those jurisdictions, which are mainly but not exclusively in the South, to get federal permission every time they change a voting law, whether it's moving a polling place or enacting a redistricting plan or a photo ID law. Those jurisdictions have to get permission from either the Department of Justice or a court in Washington to show that those changes are not discriminatory in effect. And the reason that this strong medicine was proposed was because every time, say, the NAACP went into court to get one of these struck down as unconstitutional, the jurisdictions would come back and strategically change the law so they'd replace a literacy test with a poll tax. They'd replace a poll tax with a discriminatory redistricting plan. And it was very difficult to use normal litigation to achieve civil rights aims. And so this made sure that all the new laws that were passed principally in the South were not going to make it worse for African Americans to vote.
And it has been reauthorized how many times?
Five times.
Most recently, just a couple of years ago?
In 2006, it was reauthorized for another 25 years. And several times in the early days, it was the coverage formula was changed. By coverage formula, I mean which jurisdictions were added to it. Originally, the jurisdictions that made the list were jurisdictions that had voter turnout under 50% in the 1964 election and also had a literacy test. So if you had those two types of what we call tests or devices and low voter turnout, then you were covered regardless of whether you were in the South or not, or the share of your population that was African American, say. Later on, it was added to include some areas with large language minorities. Texas, for example, was added at that point. Some counties in California and Florida. Most of New York City is added under Section 5. But there are other, sort of, as you said earlier, the usual suspects who are not there. So while it includes Louisiana, it doesn't include Arkansas. While it includes parts of Florida, it doesn't include most of South Florida, such as Miami-Dade County. It doesn't include places like Ohio and other places where we've seen issues in the last few presidential cycles.
So if it was reauthorized in 2006 for 25 years, why is it that the Supreme Court is going to hear a challenge to Section 5 of this act now? Where has the controversy been?
Well, the controversy brought this time by Shelby County, Alabama, is that things have changed in the South since 1965, and it's wrong to single them out. And these plaintiffs argue that this is, again, strong medicine, that this reverses the federal-state balance. It's sort of a typical states' rights kind of argument. Where they say, look, things are not like they were during the Jim Crow days in the South. And so, you know, it's wrong for us to be singled out for special treatment and to get federal permission each time we move a polling place.
Are things significantly different than they were in the Jim Crow days?
Yes. I don't think anyone doubts that. I mean, whether you look at the number of African Americans turning out to vote or the number of African Americans who are elected officials, they're it's night and day from what it was in the 1960s and earlier. But there are new challenges. And you sort of mentioned the New York Times op-ed I wrote where I try to stress that's still in the covered jurisdictions. While everyone agrees that there are other bad actors out there still in these areas that are covered under the Voting Rights Act, there are a lot of problems. And we saw some of them on Election Day this year. and those of us who work in this area see it more frequently.
What did we see on Election Day this year? What were the areas? There were some in Texas, weren't there, and in other parts of the South that were challenged by the Justice Department?
In Texas, their voter ID law as well as their redistricting plan were held up under the Voting Rights Act, under Section 5. The redistricting plan was even seen as being intentionally discriminatory, according to the judges in that case. And the voter ID law was said to make it more difficult, particularly for Latinos, to vote. And so that was an area where Section 5 prevented a law from going into effect. The same is true sort of in South Carolina, where it prevented it from going into effect for this election. And in some of the counties in Florida, again, it's not Miami-Dade that's covered or Palm Beach or any of those, but in some of the counties there was they held up the changes to early voting that had been proposed by the state government. And so we did see other, you know, covered jurisdictions that had enacted these voter ID laws. About 7 of the 9 states that are covered enacted voter ID laws or some other restriction on voting. Many of those were pre-cleared either before President Obama was in office or even afterwards. But we did see activity by the Justice Department on redistricting plans and some of these voting laws.
And the Supreme Court, tell us more about this, has already reaffirmed the constitutionality of Section 5 4 times, you write.
Well, that's right. Depending on how you count, either 4, 5, or 6 times, depending on what how you categorize these cases. But what's happened is the basic question, again, is how much power does the federal government have to enforce civil rights protections in the Constitution? Mm. And if you're someone who believes that that we should read that power narrowly, that Congress really has to hew very closely only to when there are constitutional violations, then one might think this preclearance regime that I described before is a little bit more than the Constitution allows Congress to have. But and the Supreme Court has, over the last 20 years or 15 or so, the Rehnquist and Roberts Court, it has restricted or narrowed the criteria for when Congress can protect civil rights. And the basic argument that they have made is that Congress only has the power to enact laws that are congruent and proportional to the constitutional violations they want to prevent. And what that means is that you can't go too far in infringing on state sovereignty, but you have to narrowly tailor the law to really get at constitutional violations. And so the argument in this case is that not only is Congress preventing constitutional violations, but it's sort of haphazard, that they're restricting all kinds of constitutional exercises of the election powers of states, as well as not tailoring the types of areas that are covered to the ones that pose the greatest constitutional threat. I should say that it's an open question as to whether this narrow standard, the congruence and proportionality standards, the one that the Supreme Court will apply in this case, because as you indicated before, they have upheld the Voting Rights Act under a much looser standard 4 or 5 times before. But that's really the issue in the Shelby County case, which is what standard's going to apply and whether the Voting Rights Act has, in a sense, become become unconstitutional over time.
Hmm. So during this election season, we saw a number of states enact voter ID legislation. Here in the state of Wisconsin, it's on hold in the courts. And the argument that was used was it was against the state constitution of Wisconsin. Is that where, when there's been a holdup of voter ID and it's been expanded to a whole lot of states, it has been because of state constitutions?
There are several areas where that's true. So Pennsylvania and Wisconsin both have federal state court orders that prevented the voter ID law from being used in this election. But in South Carolina and Texas, it was held up because of the Voting Rights Act. And then there are several other places like Virginia and other parts of the South, like Georgia, that have photo ID laws that have been upheld under the Voting Rights Act, as well as Arizona, which has a photo ID law as well.
Mm-hmm. So where do you – what's your sense of what the Supreme Court is going to be doing with this? Do you suspect a real change here, that there will be a ruling that the reelection, although it wouldn't be this specific, that we've really moved ahead so far in civil rights? We have a black president, for heaven's sakes. Who needs a Voting Rights Act of 1965?
I do think that the Supreme Court is concerned about the lack of updating of the coverage formula in the Voting Rights Act. And so I think that we saw this in a case 3 years ago out of Texas called the Northwest Austin Municipal Utility District case. In that case, the Supreme Court hinted that it was ready to strike down the laws unconstitutional, but it was going to read it narrowly to allow for a statutory exception in that case. But both from the oral argument where I sat and listened to it, as well as the opinions, it seems like Chief Justice Roberts is particularly concerned about the sort of maltreatment of the states that are covered under the Voting Rights Act and the lack of congressional investigation into which states ought to be covered and which states should not be covered.
Mm-hmm. And there are probably some who think there are more states that ought to be covered.
I think most people think there are other states that should be covered. The states that are covered are mostly but not exclusively in the South. So places like Alabama, Mississippi, Texas, South Carolina, Georgia, and Virginia are covered basically in their entirety. But it also covers Alaska and Arizona, and it covers portions of North Carolina, New York City, New Hampshire, South Dakota, and California. But it doesn't include Ohio. It doesn't include, say, Arkansas. It doesn't include the areas in Florida, which have been of greatest concern. It just covers about five counties in Florida, as well as in places like New Mexico, which also has had its share of voting problems. So there's a challenge, which is that Congress faced, and I did testify on the Voting Rights Act before the Senate Judiciary Committee went in 2006, which is that we know that the Supreme Court has upheld the current regime before, and so it was rational both for Congress and the civil rights community to keep it as is. But if we were to come up with a different type of formula, you run into the problem that you don't really know what's going to happen if you take away federal oversight from the areas that are currently covered. So the question is, well, maybe the reason things have gotten better in the South is because the Section 5 regime has forced them to think about what the Department of Justice is going to do to them if they pass discriminatory voting laws. Mm-hmm. And so it is the case for sure that African American and minority turnout generally has risen, if not to parity with whites, to significant rates, as well as African American and Latino office holding. And so since we don't have literacy tests around anymore and we don't have poll taxes, what would be the best criterion to figure out which states should be covered and which shouldn't be? And that was a very tough road to hoe 6 years ago, and it continues to be today if Congress were to update it.
And on another issue, or maybe this is somehow pertinent to the Voting Rights Act, the other thing that has happened, of course, is that you have all these states interested, mostly Republican states, in enacting voter ID laws. Is there a case that will eventually make its way to the Supreme Court? Would it be under the purview of the Supreme Court to determine whether or not these laws may be unconstitutional because of past history, because they could be deemed to not protect the voting rights, the civil rights of minorities in this country?
There's already been a case to the Supreme Court, a case called Crawford versus Marion County out of Indiana, where the Supreme Court said the voting laws, such as the photo ID law in that jurisdiction, could be constitutional. So it is true that if a photo ID law is passed in order to disenfranchise African Americans, say, that that is unconstitutional. But absent discriminatory intent, the voter ID laws that have been passed are constitutional under federal law. That is why you have Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, the plaintiffs in those cases, going into state court, because they're hoping that under the state constitutions they can get a more favorable outcome than they did under the federal constitution. And so the Crawford case is a difficult case for those who want to strike down photo ID laws as unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm. And was that, do you think, because of the makeup of the court, or was it just not very well presented that voter ID laws would not disenfranchise minority voters? I mean, a lot of people say, well, of course they do.
Well, it's not that they merely disenfranchise minority voters, but it's that you have to intentionally be trying to disenfranchise minority voters for it to violate the 14th Amendment. The fact that there might be some lower turnout as a result of a photo ID law doesn't make it unconstitutional. And it was actually Justice Stevens, who was maybe the most liberal member on the court, who joined with other conservatives in order to uphold Indiana's photo ID law. What he said was that on its face, these laws are not unconstitutional unless you can show extreme burdens for a particular group. Then maybe you can carve out an exception for them. But for the same reason that voter registration laws are going to have a disparate racial impact and other kinds of neutral regulations of the electoral systems, photo ID laws also, he said, could be constitutional.
We welcome phone calls, and let me give you our number so you can join the conversation. Our guest is Professor Nathaniel Persily. He's a professor of law and political science at Columbia, and we're talking about the Supreme Court deciding a few weeks ago to consider a constitutional challenge to a key section of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And we're getting a history of the Voting Rights Act and what this court case means, why they decided to take this up, and what the ramifications of a decision would be for voters. Our phone number, again, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, we will be talking about the film Lincoln, which opened in Milwaukee on Friday, and I had a chance to see it last night. Daniel Day-Lewis is just so good. Oh, he is so good. But it's a big movie, and it's worthy of our discussion. You know, we've taken trips to Springfield, and we went to Washington, and a lot of you are as keenly interested in his presidency as I am. Tomorrow we will speak with Harold Holzer, who's a historian and chair of the Lincoln Bicentennial Foundation. He was one of the historical advisors to this film. He's the author of Lincoln, How Abraham Lincoln Ended Slavery in America. I hope that many of you have seen the film. If you haven't, I think you'll find the discussion good preparation for seeing the film, because it does throws you right into the middle of what's going on in January of 1865, and there are a lot of characters, and it's good to know something about who they are and where their politics are and the whole process of negotiation. So you may want to prepare yourself, but I know some of you have seen the film too, and I'm really anxious to hear your response. All right, let's go to phone calls for our guest. Couple lines are open if you'd like to talk about the Voting Rights Act. We'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. Ed in Madison is our first caller. Hi, Ed.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask Professor Persily two quick questions. The first is that, to my understanding, a partisan redistricting, like a gerrymander, this has been determined by the Supreme Court to be something non-justiciable. That is, they don't want to wade into the thicket of the politics of a redistricting plan. But it seems like this Voting Rights Act is a glaring exception to that, where a racially invidious redistricting plan can, in Section 2 or Section 5, be declared unconstitutional or sent back to the state to be redrawn. And I wanted to know what the professor thought created that distinction? And my second question is, just more generally, what makes for a proper redistricting plan? I mean, I've heard that we would like to have compact districts, that we'd like to have districts of equal population or some districts with minority opportunity. But I was more interested in sort of how we strike a balance in that and what the professor thought might make for a good strategy overall.
Thank you, Ed.
Well, those are two very big questions. So let me try to condense a first semester course down to about half a minute, which is first that the partisan the Supreme Court has not said partisan gerrymanders are unconstitutional or non-justiciable. It hasn't said that they are constitutional and non-justiciable. There are four justices on the Supreme Court who have said that. Justice Kennedy has left open the possibility that they are unconstitutional. However, they have repeatedly upheld partisan gerrymanders. So while the door is slightly ajar, for the most part, litigation against partisan gerrymanders is a non-starter. On the Voting Rights Act, there's a separate question. So let's start with the Constitution for a second. It just like any other state law, a gerrymander that is intentionally discriminatory, that tries to, say, minimize African-American, Latino influence, that is unconstitutional. The Voting Rights Act says not only are intentional gerrymanders unconstitutional, but sometimes even unintentional gerrymanders, which is to say unintentionally racially discriminatory, are unconstitutional. So Section 5 says if you diminish the ability of a racial group to elect its preferred candidates of choice. And by that it means, look, if you're going to make minorities worse off in the redistricting plan, the DOJ is going to prevent it from going into effect. That has nothing on its face to do with partisanship. In fact, it sometimes hurts Democratic gerrymanders, sometimes hurts Republican gerrymanders. But you cannot have the effect of making minorities worse off. Under Section 2, which covers the entire country, not under not just Section 5, if you dilute the minority vote, it's going to be illegal under federal law. On the second question, about what makes a good redistricting plan. And that's sort of an existential question in a lot of ways. If you're interested, I had my students draw congressional plans for the entire country, and you can find them at drawcongress.org.
Oh, you do?
These,
great.
What the students did is some of these plans were based on what the caller asked about, which is compact districts based on political subdivision lines, but also complying with the Voting Rights Act. But it really depends on context. There is no perfect way to redistrict. I've been appointed by several courts to draw plans, and no matter what I do, and there are I think most people have thought they are nonpartisan plans. You're still going to get people to object to some of the criteria, no matter what.
Mm-hmm. And is there any kind of gray area between partisan gerrymandering and racial gerrymandering? Are they the same or not?
They're not the same. I mean, you could have a partisan gerrymander where there are, you know, there's only one racial group in the state. But what I think you're hinting at is that sometimes, especially in a situation which seemed to grow in this election, where race and party become what we call sort of collinear, meaning that racial minorities are consistently voting for Democrats and whites are disproportionately voting for Republicans, a partisan gerrymander can look like a racial gerrymander. And that poses some interesting problems, which is that sometimes you can make the argument that a partisan gerrymander violates the Voting Rights Act because it makes makes minorities worse off. And that is why some Republicans believe that the Holder Justice Department enforced the Section 5 in a partisan way. But as party and race become more correlated, more highly correlated, there are going to be identifiable partisan effects from enforcing the Voting Rights Act.
Thanks, Ed, for your call. Let's go to Kathy in Oshkosh. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thank you so much for this program. Ever since I saw a quote by Chief Justice this month in a Gannett paper that this issue would be reviewed, I cannot believe that this could go in a conservative direction. Anyone who's was alive in the 60s witnessed a variety of manipulations to prevent fair voting. I'm wondering if the professor, and I do thank you so much for your time, that if there's any drive to create some type of template for voting rights in that states could follow more uniformly. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Kathy.
Well, there are plenty of interest groups that have tried to do this. The Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, a group called DEMOS, as well as the more racially identified interest groups, NAACP Legal Defense Fund, et cetera, that have sort of agendas for how to develop laws that protect voting rights. The challenge is that we in the U.S. decentralize our election administration and policymaking in ways that no other country in the world does. So not only do we have 50 states with 50 different election regimes, but even those states then devolve power down to the counties. So the ballot in Miami-Dade County is going to look very different than the ballot in, you know, Tallahassee, let alone different than a ballot in Wisconsin. And so while most countries have a federal election authority that imposes uniformity around the country, we don't have that. It would be very easy to craft, for example, uniform rules of voter eligibility for the entire country and a single federal ballot that had president, Senate, and U.S. House of Representatives elections on it. It would be just one page. You wouldn't have to have the 11-page ballot you had in Florida. Congress could do that under its power to regulate elections. But we have a very decentralized system, and the states jealously guard their autonomy when it comes to election administration. So I don't see that on the horizon.
Mm. Do you think that that was part of what the president was hinting at when he made this cryptic remark on his victory speech in Chicago that, you know, he's going to have to do something about those long lines, I believe he mentioned, in Florida?
Yes. Well, it'll be interesting to see whether he moves in the direction of federal legislation or some kind of best practices for the states. Obviously, in this election, there were all kinds of criticisms of particularly Republican state legislatures that have passed laws that such as photo ID laws and restrictions on early voting. But the problems with the lines is actually not a partisan one. While it is possible that the restrictions on early voting led to these long lines, it wasn't consistently the case. A lot of what happens is just maladministration at the local level, which has led to these long lines at the polls. For example, when they have insufficient numbers of poll workers in Miami-Dade County, or they have just one person who's in charge of the poll book of registered voters for the jurisdiction. And so a line, if they didn't plan to have 500 voters show up, then you end up having that long line. But it's a solvable problem, and it's a complete embarrassment as we try to project our democratic values abroad. I mean, I think that
right.
Having some kind of commission or federal legislation to deal with this problem would be useful. But absent that, I think that we need to develop best practices in the states where we've seen that this is a problem.
Thanks, Kathy, for your call. We go to Larry in the Upper Peninsula. Hi, Larry.
Hi there. Maybe we need to back up a little bit for me, but we were talking about Chapter 5 and then Chapter 2. To me, with the idea of the Chapter 5 deals with just some places, some counties, some parts of some states, that kind of thing. Isn't there a problem with equal protection here or something? Or does nobody cares about that? What am I missing?
Well, that's a good question. So equal protection is a part of the 14th Amendment. So no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction equal protection of the laws. We ordinarily don't think of the equal protection clause as applying to states, so that, for example, if Wisconsin got a big federal grant that New York didn't get, we don't think of that as violating equal protection. But it is clear from the opinions of the justices in the Namudno case, that Texas case I mentioned earlier, as well as the oral argument, that they are concerned about the selective treatment of these states. To some extent, it's framed in terms of equal dignity to states, which is not exactly a part of the Constitution but might be seen as implied. But the other point is that if we believe that Congress only has the power to enforce civil rights laws when it's sort of where there are threats to minority voting rights and where there's real concern, then the failure to update which states are covered could make this law unconstitutional because they have not created a law which is tailored to the actual constitutional problems that exist today. Instead, they've piggybacked onto the coverage formula of the 1960s. So that's the way that argument flows as to why the federal government might be exceeding its power by selectively targeting some states and not others. And as I said earlier, it's clear that most people think that the coverage formula should be changed. Fortunately, there actually is a part of the Voting Rights Act itself. Section 5 allows for jurisdictions to bail out, meaning that if, for example, the state of Virginia or North Carolina, places that are covered, shows that for the previous 10 years they've completely complied with the Voting Rights Act and have had no charges against them or successful lawsuits that they had violated minority voting rights, then they're allowed to apply to bail out from the Voting Rights Act. And we've had actually a considerable number of lower jurisdictions like counties that have tried to bail out in the last 6 years. And just this last week, those few towns in New Hampshire that are covered have filed a bailout request.
Mm. Thank you, Larry, very much for your call. In your piece in the Times, you write, Professor Persley, civil rights groups and election reformers should begin preparing now for the likelihood that the court will strike down the Voting Rights Act. What kinds of preparations are you talking about?
Well, I think there are several questions that need to be asked. The first is, are we going to go with a jurisdiction-specific approach to the reform, or are we going to do a national law? And if we do a national law, will it be dealing with things like photo ID and redistricting and these other issues that we saw, like early voting this past time? So if we're going to go down the road of jurisdiction-specific areas, then we have to develop assuming the Supreme Court strikes down the current formula, we have to develop a good reason as to why some states are covered and not others. So that's the first sort of intellectual hurdle that needs to be jumped over. The second is this going to sort of be stuck in the federal preclearance regime that we've had for the last 50 years or so? Or is this going to be a model like most civil rights legislations where an individual who feels aggrieved just goes into court and says, look, this is illegal? Now, there are lots of really good reasons why we required the South to get federal permission for its laws 50 years ago, because they were sort of strategizing to do anything they could to go after minority enfranchisement. But the challenges are a little bit different now, as we saw in this last election cycle. And so we need to maybe tailor the law to deal with that. And finally, the redistricting issue has occupied actually most of the effort under the Voting Rights Act in the last few decades, both Section 5 and Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And so I think we need to have sort of deep conversation as to what should the principles be that govern federal control of redistricting. And there are all kinds of challenges that emerge this time, particularly with Latinos, and also how we deal with multiracial jurisdictions. And since we tend to think of the Voting Rights Act as about access to vote, but so much of the work it has done has dealt with redistricting, and so we need to revisit that.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in just one moment. Our guest this hour is Professor Nathaniel Persley, and he wrote a piece that caught our attention in the New York Times on November 14, which you can access online. We also, on our Facebook page, have his redistricting site, drawcongress.org, which might be fun for you to do at some point on our Facebook page. So that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Persley is a professor of law and political science at Columbia. Is the Voting Rights Act doomed? Is the question of the hour the Supreme Court will be taking up during this term, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Is it unnecessary and unconstitutional? Our phone number, Larry, thanks for your call. We have lines open for you, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org or leave messages on our Facebook page. If you'd like, the Kathleen Dunn Show, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, Harold Holzer, historian, scholar, chair of the Lincoln Bicentennial Foundation, who will be talking about the film Lincoln, which just opened last Friday. I hope that those of you who have seen it will join our conversation, or you will be prompted to learn as much as you can about the events of that time in history before you see the film. He will be with us. One of his books is Lincoln, How Abraham Lincoln Ended Slavery in America. And we also want to let you know that we're doing our next book club is Frederick Douglass, and we have it's November 28th, narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, which is also in the public domain. So there's all information on our Facebook page about that as well. But our next book club is November 28th, so we're getting steeped in the history of that time, that momentous, tumultuous, difficult time. What a hard time that must have been to be alive, huh? All of that's coming up. Frederick Douglass next week, tomorrow, Lincoln. Let's go to more phone calls. Mark in Bayview. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. My question has to do with whether or not a party representation by state has ever been reason to strike down, like a slate of candidates. And I'm specifically looking at Wisconsin here, where we consistently voted for Democratic representatives, and yet we're being represented by Republicans in the House and the State Senate and the State Assembly. A majority of Wisconsin voters voted for Democratic candidates, and yet that's not reflected in our representation.
Well, this is the issue with partisan gerrymandering, and what you're describing in Wisconsin actually happened nationally, and it's quite rare that this does happen, where the majority of Americans casted votes for the Democrats in congressional races, but the Democrats have a substantial minority of seats. Now, that can happen both because of partisan gerrymanders as well as just the fact that some districts are Democrats tend to be inefficiently dispersed in the population, that there are a lot of safe Democratic districts and a lot of districts that are more competitive, somewhat more competitive, that are controlled by Republicans. But the with respect to partisan gerrymanders, the Supreme Court has not found a standard for when some partisanship becomes too much partisanship, because those who draw the lines are always aware of the partisanship of the areas they're drawing. But the question is, when does it become unconstitutional? And they've had several cases actually in the last decade, one from Texas, one from Pennsylvania, where they said that even though they were egregious partisan gerrymanders, the court still upheld them.
Has it gone the other way as well, where Democrats have partisanly gerrymandered in their favor?
Yes. In fact, they probably perfected the art of it.
Aha.
I should say literally the art, because the Democrats in California in the 1980s, Phil Burton, a famous official there, said that his gerrymander of the California congressional districts was his contribution to modern art because of the way those districts looked. And also this cycle we saw in Illinois, for example, the Democrats gerrymandered the congressional districts. What happened is that the Republicans in the 2010 elections gained a higher number of state legislative seats than they've had ever since the 1920s. And so they were in a position to redraw the lines, particularly in the competitive states, places like Wisconsin, but also Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, and others, Florida, and in Texas, which gained 4 seats while it was upheld under the Voting Rights Act or put on hold. They still gained some advantage by the way they drew the lines. So it is true that the districts are somewhat biased in favor of Republicans, but a lot of that has to do with the incumbency advantages they had in 2010.
Thanks, Mark, for the call. Peter and Spooner, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for doing this, and thank you for all the information. I'm just wondering, with all Congress has on its plate right now, given all the fiscal cliff stuff and whatnot, if the Supreme Court does strike down the law, what sort of time frame do you think it would take Congress to respond to it and pass new laws or something equivalent?
That's in some way why I wrote that op-ed, to put it on people's agenda, because election reform is in some ways the most difficult type of reform for a polarized Congress to pass, since it does have identifiable partisan consequences and it actually deals with congressmen's own jobs. So it's so difficult to get election reform passed in general, all the more so given how polarized Congress is. I think that the Voting Rights Act, if it is struck down by the Supreme Court, if Section 5 is, that perhaps there'll be a policy window that opens over the summer of 2013 where people will start to think about it seriously. My hope is that we won't only think about election dysfunction in the week or so after an election, but we can plan for it far in advance. And so I would hope that Congress would come back and revisit this within the next year. But of course, we have 2-year election cycles here. So if they are to revisit the Voting Rights Act or create a Voting Rights Act of 2013, I think it probably wouldn't be in effect at least until the 2016 election, if not afterwards. And there's going to be a lot of wrangling over this. I mean, one thing, the reason it passed with unanimous support in the Senate in 2006 and all but 30 votes in the U.S. House of Representatives, despite the fact that there was a polarized Congress then as well, is that they didn't think that the partisan stakes of keeping the current regime in place were all that high. I think now there's concern that it might be, and we'll see whether it leads to some redefining of what the Voting Rights Act should be about.
Anything else, Peter?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. Here's an email from Ann in Madison. In Wisconsin, the law that's on hold requires nearly all voters to have a state-issued ID, which is onerous to obtain. It can be obtained only, she writes, at DMV locations, which have limited hours and long lines. They will try to charge $28, but it is free if you know you need to ask for a free voter ID. However, you do need to previously obtain a birth certificate in order to get the voter ID, which will cost $25. The question is, doesn't this violate the 14th Amendment as a poll tax?
Well, this has been litigated in Georgia, and it was raised in Indiana, and the courts have said no, that it's not a poll tax. This argument comes up every so often, but most photo ID laws do have that character to them, that a lot of the supporting documentation that you would need in order to get a photo ID law would cost some money. I should say, I've portrayed it as definitive. We don't have a Supreme Court decision exactly on point, but those who've tried to raise this argument under the federal constitution have been unsuccessful. And one thing I should note, for all the sound and fury dealing with voter ID laws, in the states which have them, for example, and passed them earlier, like Indiana and Georgia, we did not see either the disparate racial effects or the drop in turnout that a lot of people thought would happen. And those have relatively restrictive laws. Whether that would happen in areas that are more urbanized, say like Pennsylvania, where there are a lot of people who take public transportation in Philadelphia and who therefore don't have driver's licenses, we're not sure. And the plaintiffs in that case projected that 700,000 people wouldn't be able to vote as a result, although that's probably too high an estimate. But in general, the courts have given their blessing to the federal courts have given their blessing to the voter ID laws, unless you can show an identifiable group of people, such as the elderly, such as the disabled, who are absolutely not going to be able to vote as a result of these voter ID laws.
Do you think voter fraud is a problem in this country?
Not the kind of fraud that would be prevented by a voter ID law. I wrote another thing, I think, on CNN.com, if people are interested, about what I think it was titled Invisible Fraud versus Imaginary Voters. And the idea was that the voter ID movement is really targeting a problem that doesn't exist, which is the idea that people are going from one polling place to another impersonating voters. But there is a problem with absentee ballot fraud. And as one-third of Americans cast their votes absentee or early this past election, we really do need to think about the rising challenges posed by absentee votes, not just in the fraud realm, but also given how many are rife with errors. And so most of the fraud prosecutions that we see around the country do deal with the absentee voter pool. But these photo ID laws don't regulate those. In fact, many states that have passed these photo ID laws have made it easier to vote absentee and have actually made fraud easier. And one of the greatest ironies, I've argued, is that a photo ID law could actually increase the risk of fraud because if it shifts people from the in-person pool to the absentee voter pool, then there's a larger group of people voting by the means where we have seen identifiable fraud.
Mm. So why is there such a movement, and can you give me a historical perspective on this? Has there been a big voter ID movement in the past in this country?
Well, the current voter ID movement really begins, sort of comes out of the ashes of the 2000 presidential election controversy. After that, there was something called the Carter-Baker Commission that had proposed reforms to federal election law. And one thing they proposed was a photo ID or an ID law. As it turns out, they wanted the government to provide the photo IDs for free, but that was the first real mention of photo ID. Then came the passage of the Help America Vote Act, which was the federal legislation that was trying to respond to the problems in Florida that we saw. And so, among other things, it created provisional ballots. It gave money to states to eliminate punch card ballots. It crafted voter registration databases. But in return, the Republicans got the first federally mandated ID law. So around the country, first-time voters who register by mail have to present some form of ID when they come to the polling place. If you fast forward to the 2004 election and afterwards, then we had the so-called Acorn controversy where people were concerned about voter registration fraud. And the voter registration fraud in the surrounding 2007 or 2006 that Acorn committed, and which is also routine in elections, is when you pay off third-party groups in order to register voters. And so they register Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse. Of course, Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse don't show up on election day to vote, but this whole specter of voter fraud then came about around the time of the Obama election and before. That led to a move in many states to pass voter ID laws. And once the Supreme Court upheld those photo ID laws in the Crawford case, there was seen to be very little obstacle in the way of the more than a dozen states that passed it in the last 2 years. It is certainly, as you mentioned, it is only in the Republican states, with the one exception of Rhode Island, but their photo ID law basically has an escape hatch where if you just swear who you are, you don't have to show an ID.
Oh, really?
And so that's been, part of the mantra over the last few years has been that there's this great, big threat of voter fraud. And I should say most Americans both believe there's considerable amount of fraud in American elections, and most Americans do support these photo ID laws. Considerable majorities do.
Mm-hmm. You also say in that piece that caught our attention that we need to enact some national rules concerning provisional ballots. What's problematic there?
Well, first, a provisional ballot is the kind of vote that you cast when your registration is in doubt or if you don't have a photo ID in a state that requires it. So you show up, your name is not on the rolls, and you end up having to cast a provisional ballot. And those get counted after the election if you are able to cure the legal violation. Provisional ballots are a sort of ticking time bomb. We got lucky this election that the margin of victory was beyond the margin of litigation, but there were well over 230,000 provisional ballots cast in Ohio alone. And so if the margin of victory were within that range, then there's a real danger that you're going to be litigating over those hundreds of thousands of ballots. And so what we need is to have very clear rules as to when provisional ballots are supposed to be dispensed and when someone should be allowed to vote a regular ballot, and then also when they should be counted and for what types of legal violations.
Mm-hmm. You certainly know your material, sir. I thank you very, very much for being with us. It was such an informative hour. Thank you.
Well, Thank you very much.
Yeah. And the piece that he wrote, we'll put it on our Facebook page as well, Is the Voting Rights Act Doomed? Well worth your attention. It is November 14, New York Times op-ed part of the paper. He also, as we were saying, has this, he makes his students do redistricting of districts all over the country. And that site, drawcongress.org, is posted on our Facebook page. You have some time off during Thanksgiving, it might be a great family activity. You can look at democracy and have a project to do, like doing a big puzzle. Professor Nathaniel Persily is a professor of law and political science at Columbia University. And we thank him for his time. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock. A reminder that tomorrow we are talking about the Lincoln movie, which I did see last night. Theater was pretty crowded for a Sunday evening. I thought that was good, and it's a big film. There's a lot in the film, and I'm really looking forward to talking about it with you and with Harold Holzer, who is a historian, who is a Lincoln expert and was one of the advisors to the movie. Great conversations ahead.